Hey guys, we produce this podcast for no other reason than to have a positive impact on the lives of you guys, the listeners, by sharing the stories and lessons of some incredible business owners. If you'd like to support our show, please head to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, rate us 5 stars and leave a review. Your review would be greatly appreciated and keeps us going. And now back to the show. Hello, legends. Today, I catch up with Cub member Richard Theodorakis, CEO of Pride Security Australia, a security company that in just 4 years went from a man with a car to 100 security guards across the nation. Richard and I discuss the situation in Bondi Junction and how security companies and guards are able to react to situations like that. How he went from one man to a national company with over $10 million in revenue and the mindset it takes to make a business successful. Richard has some amazing stories. Enjoy the show. I mean, you have to be the fastest growing service-based business I've ever met. 0 to 100 staff in, what is it, 4 years?
Yeah, just shy, yeah.
That's fast.
105, actually. I just looked earlier today when we were going through some things. It is fast, yeah.
And you're a security business. I mean, your business is kind of the scary topic of the day after what's recently happened in Bondi Junction. I imagine you would have to speak to a lot of to your employees about, you know, even more training and safety or?
Yeah, look, it makes you reflect. You know, with so much spotlight on the companies involved, anytime something like this happens, there's a lot of finger pointing, of course, but it makes us look at our own procedures, and we put ourselves in their shoes and say, it's out of their control to some degree. Obviously they can't control that there are crazy people out there and these things can happen. But leading up to that point where there's a staff member facing something like that, that's what you can control. And so we've done a lot of reflecting the last few days on that. And we've found some weak points that we could be doing better. The highlight really is that we are doing a lot right because it's a focus of ours for a long time. But it's a scary thing. You know, the public sees security getting softer and softer in terms of their approach. You know, some businesses are basically your security and your cleaners are in the same uniform. You know, I was quoted by 7U saying yesterday that cleaners have more weapons available to them than a security cart does.
It's actually true.
They've got a cleaning cart.
Yeah, yeah. You know, slide a bucket at them, trip them over and crack them with the broom.
Throw some bleach in his eyes, you know.
Yeah, it's actually true.
It's completely true and it's scary because what we've seen is that the public are really looking to security to go, hang on a minute, you know, we weren't just walking the street. We were in a shopping center with a security team. We're told we're safe. That's why we're there, you know. But what happened? Why weren't we safe? What was the procedure? You know, there was a police officer who responded very bravely on her own. If she wasn't there, was she there just getting lunch? You know, and if that didn't happen, how long would the response have been? Because it was a very fast response typically for police. You know, it's a good location for that, but not all shopping centres are, especially smaller ones. We had another unfortunate incident last night at a church where we saw that unfold, a very different scenario. The same weapon and a similar attack. The response being very different though.
What was the response in that case?
Well, just to recap, during a church service, a bishop was stabbed multiple times, including another member of the staff there, and I believe some members of the public by a 15-year-old boy.
Oh my God.
This is in Sydney's West. And again, it was a surprise. No one knew what had happened. It's, you know, with a young boy as well. So that's another thing to look at, but, you know, motivated by something, has led to it. And at the time, everyone that was there for the service rushed in, to try and help. They ended up pinning the guy to the ground, the attacker, removing the knife from him and 4 or 5 people just held him to the ground until police responded. It very quickly got out what had happened. It was in a Syrian church and they're a very deep church community. So the response in the community was, we've got to go and help, and that poses its own threats. It got a bit violent between the public and police. Obviously there's a lot of emotion in a scenario like this.
With a religious circumstance.
Absolutely. And that's a member, you know, of a really tight-knit community that's been affected there. So, you know, there would have been a lot of emotion involved. That's typically someone that knows the community very well. So, yeah, there was a very difficult situation with police. They were trapped inside with the offender with no idea how to get him out, basically, because everyone outside wanted to get him.
Yeah, they were going
to
kill him.
Yeah.
They probably would have.
And they would have, 100%.
When there's that many people, you get that kind of mob mentality where, you know, everyone just starts going, yeah. Isn't that an amazing, though, human trait that we have? It's like, I actually read something, this, like, I don't want to say it like this, but this was what I read once and it's kind of applicable, which is like, this is science, but humans actually get dumber in larger groups. So the larger the group, the worse decision making humans make. I read that. I can't remember where I read that, but it was based on science, and I believe it because it is those large groups where people start kind of lashing out and doing random things, and you know, I imagine that in a company like yours, with you know, you're providing security services to venues across the country. Am I correct?
Yeah.
That you would be probably pretty concerned right now, because when there's also statistics that show when people see something in the media, that thing happens more. You know, like when people see people committing suicide and the media shows that, more people then commit suicide. When people see a stabbing, more stabbings happen. So is that something now that you're thinking, okay, I need to speak to?
Look, it was definitely one of my first thoughts when we saw what happened at the church is, you know, we've got two people we don't know much about, both of them known to police for other reasons. Was one motivated by the other? You know, you've got to ask these questions. In one case, the offender's dead, in the other, he's alive. So they can only ask one person these questions. But two people at very different stages of their life. It's a 40-year-old and a 15-year-old. So you can assume maybe the agenda wasn't the same. But regardless, it reflects on community and where we are as a country. Mental health is a big problem. And they're obviously attributing to both incidences. And the scary part about both, I think, for the public is, what do you do about it? You know, Bondi is our home away from home for me and my wife. You know, one of the more difficult stories to digest was the mother that was stabbed holding a 9-month-old baby. The baby was also stabbed. You know, I've got a 4-month-old daughter. We just had our first child. I go to that shopping centre all the time with my wife. You know, we're watching the videos and thinking, we were literally walking there last week and you know, you find out he's stabbing people from behind. They don't know it's coming, and people see some ruckus going on, people running around, and they just assume, oh, it's just kids playing up, you know, it's school holidays, so you continue on. And that's what's scary about it, because there is no clear answer on what you do.
Well, I mean, I think the clear answer is ramping up security everywhere. Like, the world went through this kind of trend phase stupidity, I'd call it, of like, you know, the whole defund the police.
Yeah,
and like that.
Yeah.
You know, I went to Paris, like, I grew up in Paris. When I was there, there were literally army soldiers with machine guns on all major tourist sites everywhere, like, and police everywhere on all the luxury streets and everything. Mm. You always felt safe. Like, even when there were, like, you know, shady characters around you, you still felt safe because, you know, you were like, okay, well, there's like a guy there and a guy there and a guy there and they all have machine guns. So, you know, I'm feeling pretty secure.
Yeah.
Whereas I went back last year and I literally almost got mugged twice and felt uncomfortable. There was not a police in sight. Yeah. And I think, like, I mean, this isn't directly the same to, you know, a shopping center, but my point being that the more, like, in today's world, people are getting more and more mentally health affected. Like, mental health is just between lockdowns, social media,
political
inflation,
divisiveness.
Everyone's fighting. People are losing their minds.
Yeah.
And it's a time where we need to be ramping. I mean, we need to be helping people mentally and creating environments, and you know, we need to be limiting the potential for something like that to happen.
Yeah.
But I think that in the meantime, we need to be ramping up security in all places. Like, even Potts Point, sorry to ramp on, but Potts Point where I live, there's a lot of, like, you know, people that aren't mentally stable on drugs roaming the streets. Mm. You could argue that, but that's fine. You know, they're not doing anything. Yeah, okay, but what happens when someone does lose their mind, pull out a knife and do something to someone? Yeah. You know, that shouldn't be, I don't think that should be allowed. I think we need more security on our streets and enough.
Yeah, well, addiction fuels a lot of problems, and where we see the most basic crime, you know, whether it be robbing shoe stores or 7-Elevens, you know, places with quick cash or cigarettes or things easy to sell, a lot of the time it's people trying to fuel an addiction, you know, because they've run out of money. It's very hard to deal with an addiction when you don't have what you think is going to cure that hunger pain you've got for it. And that drives a lot of it on a basic level. But that's somewhat clear on how we can prevent it. You know, we can go to the people in the streets, for example, and try and treat them. But just some dude who grew up on a farm in Queensland, you know, or some kid from the suburbs, they're the scary ones because you don't know where they are.
Yeah, you can't find them.
And so, you know, homelessness is a growing problem as well. But again, there's so much in place for those people to get them food, to get them comfort. And again, they're obvious to find. It's the ones you can't find that are what are scaring people now, because you assume that there's going to be some story come out like he's just escaped jail and we were looking for him, and it's not the case. It's just some dude that moved here a month ago. You know, I jumped on his Facebook page after it happened, and 3 days earlier he's posting in a surf group looking for someone to surf with on Bondi.
No way.
Scary. And people are commenting, hey, mate, yeah, let's catch up. You know, and 3 days later this is what happens. And I think that's what's really freaking out the community, because, you know, when you're sitting around the dinner table asking yourselves, what do we do now? There is no answer. And the government know that, you know, Westfield know that. You know, I did an article last night, and one of the responses from Westfield was that, and I think he's going to cop some shit for this just quietly. I think it was the CEO of Westfield said he believes that the response worked well, which is obviously insensitive to the people affected. But what it shows is no thought to change.
Yeah, well, I would argue that no response from what, I mean, look, I don't know enough about the situation, but the response was sorted by an off-duty police officer,
yeah,
who bravely saved everyone's lives. Yeah.
Lucky she had a gun, by the way.
Yeah, of course.
If you remove the guns, then what?
Yeah.
Because that was the only thing that was going to stop this guy. You know, there's, of course, we can look at this scenario in hindsight and go, oh, you could have done this, you could have done that. You know, one thing I tell everybody is, dude, there's fire extinguishers everywhere in a shopping center. They're literally the best thing.
Is that right?
Spray someone in the face with a fire extinguisher and watch them just hit the ground.
Really?
It kills your eyes.
And I guess
regardless
can't
of the type, it's either going to be foam or, you know, some are just water, but it's still a water jet hitting you, and that distraction's enough for someone to grab them or hit them with something to drop the weapon, or fire extinguishers are everywhere. No one grabs them. Even a fire hose, real. The pressure that comes out of those things will stop anyone.
Wow. And so how equipped are actual security guards?
Yeah, well, there's a scale to it, you know, and what it actually comes down to is responsibility. So you could have a basic security guard with nothing but a radio and limited training, you know, new to the industry. That was the scenario we had on the weekend. You could have a full-blown armed guard with body armor, bulletproof vests. You know, I've got a bulletproof vest ready to be shot with an AK-47. Plenty for that scenario, unless, of course, he gets you in the head. But it's going to protect most vitals. The chances of even getting an artery in your arm or leg are pretty slow, so are pretty limited. So, you know, that kind of equipment could have had a different response. If it was an armed security guard, he could have put him down. The laws that police acted under to shoot him are the same laws anybody could shoot someone for in Australia.
Even a security guard.
Anybody with a license to carry a firearm, basically. It's the a real and impending threat to life was posed. That's the political term you'll hear them using. And anytime there's a real and impending threat to life, you can protect yourself with the equivalent force, which in this case is lethal. So, you know, if there was a cash in transit truck there with a firearm and somebody threatened his life or somebody in front of him, it would have been the same outcome.
So if a pedestrian, like let's say there was a young male there and he was standing next to a kitchen store and saw this happening, if that young guy had grabbed a knife and killed the man that was killing all the women and whatnot, would that person be charged, or is that person allowed to do that?
This is a great point, because I'm actually writing something about it at the moment, because it's a very grey area. And normally where people come unstuck working under the citizen arrest laws, that's what it comes under. You know, we hear stories of people in the country having their houses broken into and they grab the rifle out and chase the guy down.
That happens,
you know,
all the time.
Happens all the time.
Like, I've got a country house. Hasn't, thank God, happened to me. But, like, you hear about those stories.
Happens all the time. Yeah. And so to use that as an example, the guy's in your house, he's got a knife or gun and he's pointing it at you, and you've got a gun that you legally own for hunting, but it's there. If you shoot him, no problem. But if he turns around and runs away and then you shoot him, you're in jail. You know, so there was a story not long ago of somebody who had that scenario happen. They didn't shoot the offender, but they did capture him, place him under arrest, put him in their car and drive them to a police station while taking his long arm with him. He rocks up to the police station and he was arrested. Because they're like, what are you doing, dude? You can't do that. You're driving around with a loaded firearm. You got a dude arrested in the back of your car. Like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
But it's that brain fog. You just go, holy crap, I've got to stop him. And then now you've stopped him. You're like, oh, even better. I'll make sure he doesn't get away. I'll just take him to the police and then you're the one in jail.
Yeah. Well, it's a tough one because you can't have citizens going, like, becoming vigilantes because at the end of the day, they could be the ones that get hurt or they could accidentally hurt someone else.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, if there's someone there that could have stopped that man before he had inflicted damage on anyone, you know, you would be like, okay, well, that's...
Well, this is the point of the law. It's meant to be...
Which maybe means there should have just been more security guards.
Yeah, well, the point of security guards is everybody in Australia has laws that can help them protect themselves, but most people don't know them and that's where security really come into it. We don't have any extra powers than a citizen does. But we have the ability to use those powers and be educated on them a bit better. There are a few things we have additionally. We can carry batons and handcuffs if you're permitted to. You can, of course, carry firearms. But really the asset of a security guard is that they know more about the standard law than the average person does. So in that case of, you know, something happens out the front of a knife shop and you just grab a knife, if there's a real and impending threat to life, you can use up to lethal force to stop it. But the second... You know, for example, they've got a knife. The second he goes from having a knife to just dropping it and punching you, now you've got to drop your knife and punch him back. There's no, you know, there's argument that you're allowed one step above. So you could argue in court that if he's punching you, you're allowed a knife. But the reality is when the threat stops, you have to stop. And that's where most people cross the line. Normally,
yeah, because emotions are high. You're angry. You might have seen something horrible. Yeah. They might have done something to a loved one.
Yeah. And sometimes that's not the case either. It's a fact of let's pin this guy down. Let's make sure he gets caught and five guys pile on top of him. Positional asphyxiation is a major problem with citizens' arrest where they don't intentionally kill the person, but five guys pile on top of you means you can't breathe. Mm. That person dies and now who's accountable? You know, and the more these stories come out, the more it'll probably educate people on what they can and can't do. You know, we say that, you know, we hear this all the time, but they say stay calm. No one explains why though. And until you're in that situation, you don't understand why. Because if you don't stay calm, you start acting out of passion, out of reason, out of what you would normally do. Whereas if you actually stop, unless of course the threat's literally coming at you, but if you have time to stop for 2 seconds and say, what can I actually do? That's when you can look for a fire extinguisher or ask someone else who's maybe not able to help to call police while you can go and deal with the situation. Or so that first 5 seconds of thought can make a huge difference at the end of the day. And especially in security, we see it all the time where, and it happened to me early in my career as well, where I'd be faced with something. I worked as an armed guard for a long time where we would respond to break-ins, and it's a service most people don't realise exists, but, you know, the police aren't kept on a KPI. Police turn up when they want to turn up, but security, when you hire them, you know, there's services in place that they've got to say, we'll be there in 15 minutes or half an hour or whatever the scenario is. So
I have that at the farm.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so we do that and... you know, so for us turning up, often we're the first there, sometimes with an offender present. And I remember a few stories early on, you know, where I had a guy pull a needle on me. I used my baton to hit the needle out of his hand, which worked, and then I arrested him.
And it was a home break-in?
He had just gotten out of jail the day before and he had robbed a 7-Eleven to get money. And then he went to a building site, which was near completed, to charge his phone. And so we rock up to a dude just simply charging his phone. You're like, come on, mate, you can't jump someone's fence and charge your phone, you know. And then
– so the alarm was triggered because he technically broke into the building to charge his phone.
Yeah. And so, you know, it started out as an honest conversation and then he, oh, just let me grab my ID because I said, where's your ID? You know, the police are on the way. And because at the end of the day it's trespass. So, you know, that gives us a legal requirement of keeping him there and getting police to come and talk to him. So he says, oh, I'm fumbling for my ID and he rips out this needle. And first thing I did was grab my baton out, break it out of his hand and chase him down the road. And we had this huge arrest and they're screaming and he's carrying on and I didn't want to let him get away with it. I probably just should have. But it was like 7 minutes before I radioed anybody to tell them what was going on. And that's a long time. That's a long fight. Anyone who's fought anybody ever knows it's a long time. And I was exhausted and he was exhausted and the cops never ended up turning up. And so after this huge elaborate scenario and all these things carry on and we found out later that he was released from jail because I did end up getting his ID. I arrested him, got his ID. He told me his details actually after it all ended. We relayed it to police. They went, oh, yeah, we know him, but we're too far away. Just let him go. you know, and people and so don't realize that happens.
You're allowed to arrest someone? Do you have to be, can a citizen arrest someone, like citizen's arrest, or do you have to be like a licensed security guard or?
Yeah, good question. So security operate under the citizen's arrest laws, basically. But what security have is handcuffs. So the question is, what is an arrest? An arrest is literally, hey, sit there and you're not allowed to move. They're under arrest. And so security have the ability to use handcuffs. And to be honest, most of the time it doesn't come to that. Most of the time, if you catch someone in the act, they're not willing to do what it's going to take to escape, so they'll just wait, you know, is what happens 99% of the time. But like anybody, like the farmer, you know, everyone's got the right to protect themselves. They've got the right to stop somebody committing an offence or continuing an offence. The only clear difference between what police can do and actually just anybody walking the street is police can act on suspicion and prior information. So they can see the dude walk by and go, oh, he broke into somewhere last week, I'm going to grab him. We can't do that. We have to see someone commit an offence, and when we do, we can act on it.
And a security guard, so you know, for these like high-powered people that have a bodyguard perhaps drive them around,
yeah.
Does that bodyguard have a gun on them, or are they legally allowed to have a gun or not allowed to have a gun?
The security industry work in a lot of grey areas. The direct question of, can you carry a gun to guard a person? Absolutely not. It's not legal whatsoever.
Can they carry cash? Someone told me that.
If you're protecting something that person's carrying, you can carry the firearm for that. So you may be acting in two security capacities. You might be armed to carry to protect his cash, or maybe a swipe pass to his building or the keys to his car, whatever it might be. There's no dollar value. So it can just be he wanted the keys to his house to be protected. No worries. He's got a Ferrari in the garage. Good on him. He wants to keep it. So in that scenario, you're acting in two capacities basically. And then what you want to hope is that nothing happens and you don't end up in court, because then you've got to explain why it was really necessary for that to happen. Because at the end of the day, the goal is to have less of these scenarios in security. They want to push more of it to police. It's why we see what happened in Westfield probably result in no change to policy, because the reality is if a police officer shoots someone in Westfield, all of the legalities that led up to it and when do they pull the trigger and how many shots are fired and did they reassess in between every shot, all these really deep questions that come out of it, that just gets pushed to the police. Whereas if that was a security guard,
it opens up legal work for Westfield or for any company that security guard did that.
And so, you know, like I said, firearms doesn't have to be the answer, but there's many other ways that could have been handled, like any situation. But it requires training, it requires thinking out of the box, you know, and security guards just don't get that kind of training typically.
And so you were a security guard, or how did you start your journey?
Yeah, so I was a venue manager working in some venues in Melbourne. I started out. And through all of my career, through bartending and when I got into security, I always worked for business owners. I never worked for a large corporate or anything like that, or an events company that, you know, I always worked somewhere you met the owner. You always knew who he was. And I always liked that because I'm a good negotiator. I always thought I'd get the better end of the deal if I could talk to the person that was the decision maker rather than hoping that someone in HR wants to put you in a position that you're
lifted
paying
up the award.
Yeah, exactly. So, I started out in hospitality and I really enjoyed it. I made a career change between two venues that was a bad change. I went to a venue that I thought I was going to be working for an honest owner. He was an ex-banker. He had some really busy venues at the time, which I had an opportunity to manage one of, and it took about 5 minutes before I realised he was as dodgy as they get.
Well, he's a banker.
Yeah, exactly, basically, yeah. He learned all the tricks and went and used them. So everyone was on cash and everyone was underpaid and the venue sucked because he used cheap PR and cheap, you know, marketing, and nothing was done properly. And I just thought, I'm not going to learn anything here. I'm working night shift. You know, I just met my missus shortly before. We went out married. This is 10 years ago. And so we had this security company there at the time that had the Crown Casino Melbourne contract, and I thought that'd be a cool job, similar skill set. You know, if you're a venue manager, you know, most of the job of keeping people happy, which is most of security's job as well. So I just called the owner one day and said, will you give me a job? And he said, absolutely, I'll give you a supervisor role at Crown and pay you more than what you're on. So I just went and did my license and got to the casino, and that was for a private company. I didn't work direct for the casino. Realised that not too much was different from my previous job and all the things that were going on behind closed doors. So in my head, the way to get to any kind of professional role was to find somewhere I can carry a gun, because I thought, you know, surely all these stupid things like cash payment or dodgy insurance, it can't be happening, you know. And so I ended up working somewhere where luckily that was the case. They were really by the book, did everything really well. And what I learned was there is this market insecurity of doing things on the, I won't say extreme end, because what we do is not extreme, but on the more professional end, you know, of people that need more than just some dude turning up with basic training. And so that's where I worked as an armed guard. That's where I learned how to arrest people, how to carry a firearm. I worked with people that had been in shootings and had been shot at while working in security. And you learn a lot from hearing from those people. And I worked my way up in that business and really enjoyed it. But me and my fiance at the time, this is 4 years ago now, December, Christmas Day 2019, we moved to Sydney. We literally just came up here on a holiday to visit my mum, and she just passing comment at lunch, oh, you guys should move up here. And I thought, there's no way my missus is going to move you. I had no family in Melbourne, and all of her family was in Melbourne. And she just went, that's not a bad idea. And literally 2 months later, we'd packed up our lives and here we were.
Wow.
And so I learned a lot from that business and about security and how to do it differently. And so we moved to Sydney and I just got a job at another licensed venue because it's the easiest place to get work really in security. And then COVID hit. I was at a
no more job.
Yeah, I was at a venue. My wife was working at Kathmandu at Parramatta Westfield, and so she had some work because they were still doing click and collect and things like that. But my paycheck evaporated, and it only was a few weeks of looking for more jobs before I realised there's not much opportunity is going to come from the next few years. It's going to be a lot of low end work for dodgy pay because in these climates that people thrive on the lowest cost, you know, because everyone's freaking out, no one's spending money. So I knew that would result in me getting paid less. You know, that's how our industry works, unfortunately. And so I ended up at one of the national chains of bottle shops. The employment terms were $18 an hour, and there was a huge shortage in the industry because a lot of people went back home, and our industry is hugely staffed by people from overseas on student visas or working visas and things like this. So there was a huge shortage of staff, and we were basically told, hey, it's $18 now. You have to work 7 days because we don't have enough people to split the shifts. It's 13 hours a day during the week, 16 hours on Saturday, Sunday. And if you don't want it, the next guy will. And you just had no choice. And that didn't last long before the quarantine hotels opened. So I actually moved to a quarantine hotel. I was one of the first security supervisors at a quarantine hotel. Which was liaising between the contract holder that I worked for as well as police and military. We're at one of the hotels that had a base there. So I thought I'd be all right there for a while. And then 2 weeks into that job, we got a phone call saying the company that has the contract for the quarantine hotel has found someone to do it cheaper, to staff it cheaper. And so we went from being paid the award, which averages about $40 an hour, and we were told it's now $25 an hour and it's cash, and if you don't like it, find another job. So it just kept happening. And to me, it just kept saying, you got to stop putting your faith in other people and you got to figure it out for yourselves. And when I worked at the last business as an armed guard in Melbourne, that really fueled me to want to get into business for myself. I just didn't know how or when or why. And so the last few years of being in Melbourne, I started watching some business podcasts and reading books. And my dad's a business owner. He's been working for himself for a long time in a family business my grandparents started. My mum's always been in the corporate side of things. So you know, I thought I've probably got the advice. I need to piece it together. I've just got to figure out how and why and what I'm going to do. And, you know, we thought, oh, we'll start a venue business, you know, and we'll just do pubs and clubs and COVID, of course. So I'd had the business name and the logo and everything just sitting in the background while I was trying to figure out what to do with it. And you know, when that switch happened at the quarantine hotel, I just went home to my fiance at the time and said, we've got to do something for ourselves. You know, because we were living in mum's spare bedroom with no money.
$18 an hour.
Yeah, $18 an hour, $1,500 in saving, credit card debts, two cars on loans, you know, like it wasn't looking good. And so I just said, there's got to be money in security somehow. I'm sure we can figure it out. You know, my skill set was in patrols because that's what I'd been doing. It is the highest barrier to entry in our industry because you've got to have a vehicle, you've got to have sign of writing, you've got to have all these things in place that turning up to work at a shopping center doesn't need you to have, even if you win the contract. But we figured maybe that'd be our difference. So we convinced my dad to get us a loan for the car. We made every payment, but no one would give us a loan because I'd been working for cash and that was jobless. So the banks were like, yeah, no chance. So dad helped us out. We got the car. We used the last $1,500 to put some sign writing on it and apply for our license, which at the time was just to work for myself. There's a smaller license you get just to employ yourself basically in the industry. It's only a few hundred bucks. And I one day I just jumped in the car and drove down Parramatta Road door knocking.
Door knocking businesses?
Yeah, everything. Car yards, whatever I could think of basically. And that's basically how we started, with one uniform in one car and just driving around Parramatta.
And saying what? Do you have any security needs?
I worked very briefly in Melbourne when I first moved there. Grew up in Canberra, moved to Melbourne at just turned 20. And that was in between bartending jobs. It was very hard to get a bartending job in Melbourne at the time. I wasn't good looking enough, I think, is probably the problem. But I think, you know, I just didn't have the skill set needed, or maybe I was too young. I don't know what it was, but I couldn't get good work anyway. So I found some sales company that wouldn't tell you what you were selling, and I thought, this can't be good, but I'll give it a crack. And I turn up and it's door knocking, selling solar systems. So literally you'd just get in a bus with 20 backpackers. They'd drop you off in the middle of the suburbs, and they just said, here's a list of 200 houses, go and door knock them all. And if someone agrees to talk to you, then call this number and they'll book an appointment and send a salesperson out. So I had the basic idea of writing a pitch, you know, how to get through to somebody and not just get the door shut in your face. And so I really drew down on that skill set in the early days and just said, let's sit down, do a basic script. We'll cold call people, you know, we'll just jumping on Google Maps, typing in Sydney mechanics and calling everyone that popped up, you know, and trying to sell our services. And
So how long did it take you to go from you in a car driving around, living in your mum's spare bedroom with your fiance?
Yeah.
How long did it take you to go from that to, okay, wow, this business is working, like, I don't know, maybe 100 grand a month or something like that?
Yeah, good. So it was a journey, you know, and I think that's what I love about Cub, is meeting people that have been down that path. Because what I will say is, I'm somebody, you know, I'm a bit of a bloke's bloke. I'm not an emotional person, but that was really testing, you know, and in my mind, it was always going to work and I was never going to quit. There was just, it just wasn't a reality because we had no other option. I didn't have a skill set to go back to. Didn't have a university degree. I barely passed year 12. I had no course. I had a year 12 certificate from a pretty good school, but with pretty dodgy grades. And I was a bartender and a security guard. So, you know, there's not a lot of opportunity there. So I just knew if this doesn't work, we don't have any other options. Moving back to Melbourne and getting my old job back was an option, but I'd have to swallow my pride for that one. And so, you know, we just started and problem solved. The nuts and bolts of it are, I worked just under 600 days straight. And that sounds not so bad to most entrepreneurs until you realize that 600 days of not just selling, because that's what most people do when they start a business, but someone had to do the work. And it's all at night. It's not like if you started an accountant firm, you could win a customer and then when you got a bit of money, you can do a bit of the work, do a bit of sales, then go to bed. It was like every bit of work we won, someone had to do at 3 a.m. and it had to be me.
So you would sell during, you will drive around selling during the day and then you'd work all night.
Yeah. And so when we only had a couple customers, I'd be in bed by midnight. You know, then you get up at 6 a.m, 7 a.m, try again. And then you'd win a bit more and you'd be up to 1. And then it became 2 and then it became 3 and then it became 6 a.m. And they're all, you know, in patrols, which is what we started. You're charging people a few bucks to check a door. You're not getting billed per hour. So to build up enough work is really hard. Certainly we didn't have enough work to even pay someone to take one night off, basically, is what it came down to. And so that's what dragged out the time frame more than anything, is that it was trying to get past that barrier of enough money to put someone on, but then what's the point of having one night off? That's not going to fix any of our problems either. We're better off with the $300-$400 it's going to cost to put them there. So we just pushed through 600 days almost, day and night, 16-hour days, flat out. About a year in, my wife stepped back and started trying to help a bit more as well. She went to casual instead of full-time. And then we finally won a client that was our main breakthrough, I guess, and it was a static guarding site. So we could actually put people there a few hundred hours a week, bill them hourly, and that then had enough profits to put someone on the road 3-4 days, you know, Monday to Wednesday, to give me some sleep and continue on. And
so that was the first time you weren't the everything.
Exactly.
You
were,
it became a business in the sense. Like it wasn't a job anymore.
Yeah. And it's funny because at that time we literally didn't even know how to process a payroll. You know, like we signed up to zero. And we got terrible advice. There's plenty of stories there. But, you know, we're watching YouTube just how to do a pay run. Got no idea to do it. What do you have to put on a pay slip? You know, we didn't have these skill sets. And some people do, some people don't. I'm not unique in that way, but it was just all the challenges you face as trying to grow a business. And so getting off the road was our first big thing. And, you know, there were a lot of emotional things that happened during that 600 days. You know, pets passed away. I lost my grandmother. You know, I hadn't gone to bed with my wife in 600 days, literally. You know, we'd have dinner together. I'd go back to work. She'd go to bed.
That's not good for marriage.
It's not easy. She was always a believer in us and that we could do it. So that was never an argument in our house that it was, that's the way it was. It's just how it was.
So it truly is a husband and wife business. It was.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. My wife still operates in the business every day. We make every decision together. And so, you know, that was our first, okay, this is going to work. We think we've got what it needs to potentially keep enough people happy that we can bring more work in than we lose. Luckily we've never really actually lost any work. Projects finish, of course, but, we've always had that kind of good customer relationship. So then, you know, the second big breakthrough, and I'll never forget, the first time we did $100,000 a month was like, I can't believe it. You know, our first 12 months we did 120,000, and almost all of that was out the door in expenses because we had to pay for a car and the fuel and all the things that go along with it. And a lot of that was tied up in other people's wages as well as we put our first staff on.
Yeah, you probably had 120 in revenue. You probably spent 200.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get money back for a change on the basses, you know, on the GST. and so, you know, I'll never forget the first time we did $100,000 in a month. And then, but it doesn't compare to the first time you do $1 million in a month.
It's a big difference.
It's like, you know, the feeling is just insane. Of we sit back and just go, how did this even happen?
Whoa, what have I done?
Yeah, you know, like it's just, and it for us, it happened so quick that you start to think it's normal. And it's not till you meet other people that are in business or not and you start telling them and you know, the other day we were in a call group and we were talking about revenue and I casually said, oh, we're doing about 300 grand a week. And this guy was like, what? You know, but to us, it's so normal now because, of course, that's not all going in my pocket. We've got a lot of wages, 105 staff. You know, there's a lot of outgoings. But to get to that size in such a short time, if you don't convince yourself it's normal and just adapt to it and start thinking, you know, this isn't enough, we've got to keep growing. You know, it's very easy to get complacent in business. Most people that turn over that kind of money or the profits we have would have probably been pretty happy with it, you know, whereas we're just as hungry now as we were when I was back in that car on my own.
But how did you actually get to that scale? Because you are you're a service-based business.
Yeah.
How do you scale that quickly? Because, I mean, let's say you've been open for 4 to 5 years now. The first 18 months, I'm going to assume, well, really your first almost, 18 months, 600 days was, you know, just you, which means you went in a matter of 2 to 3 years from just you to 100 staff and revenue you just said then. How did that happen? How did that trigger? That it almost sounds like what? Like
yeah, it doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. I met a lot of businesses. Yeah. I mean, it's what I do.
Yeah. And so that's very our first year we did, I think it was 129 to be exact. Our second year annoyed me because we did like 981 and I was like, oh, so close. that competitiveness, you can't help it, you know. And of course we were amazed that we had almost 10x'd, you know, 7x'd, 8x'd in 12 months, but it was still just, it's that mindset of, oh, we were so close. Whereas most people just would have been so happy that where you got where you were. And then last end of financial year, we grew about 4 times on top of that. And then in the last 9 months, we've
exploded
almost 3 times again.
But where do you find your clients?
Very difficultly, I guess is a short answer. There's no, you know, I've got stories of how much money we've lost trying to do marketing and Google ads and all these things. And the truth is it's just all blood, sweat and tears. In the service-based industry, most people have a problem they aren't looking to solve, whether it's a cleaner or a security guard or someone to manage their bins or fuel cards. There's so many services that aren't the direct, you know, problem of that business. If you're an accounting firm, you're not thinking about security. And when your security system breaks, you're like, oh, so annoying, but I'm too busy to fix it. You just leave it there. So, you know, ours is all cold calling, door knocking, just getting out there, educating people on what we do differently. You know, we started out with just a few services and tweaked them on how we could do them differently. Because if you're just walking in saying the same thing as the next guy, it's very hard to create value. We all know that. And we're certainly a premium service, not the low hanging cheaper guys. So you've got to sell based on that. And one thing we've always done since day one has been very forward on just doing everything properly. you know, so that when we did grow, we could make claims like we have a modern slavery policy, we do, you know, adhere to it, we do have a huge back end of operational policies for safety of staff and loan workers and operating a vehicle and all these things. And we've been talking about all those things since it was just me in a car, which meant as we scaled and these larger businesses start looking at us, we've actually got it all there.
So you are a premium service, which would also make it easy for you to know who to target in terms of, like, you want to go for the companies that are premium or more premium companies or more prone to problems happening.
Yeah, well, the conversation we have is we need to find people that have lost something or have something they don't want to lose, to crime, to fire, to anything. You know, if you look at a school, for example, we do a lot of schools. And what does a school want?
No, I don't want to lose my kid.
Well, not just that, but the branding of the school. You know, if you're just talking about the safety of the people, it's very hard to sell because the safety of the people can be drummed up to just a person standing there. Just put a security guard there. It's the easy solution. You know, but when you help them understand actually how much risk they're at outside of that box, outside of, I just have a security guard at the gate to make sure everyone that enters is actually a parent of a kid or, you know, those basic things. What about at night when there is no one there? Because if they just think the only importance to their school is when it's staffed and when there's children there, then that's all you can sell on. But for us, it's always been, what if someone breaks in the middle of the night and does something to a room or graffiti something that you can't have students and teachers see or sets fire to something? Or there's so many things that can happen at night. And how are you going to open your business tomorrow if that happens? And what is the trust of the parents that are going to turn up tomorrow morning if they see that something's happened to your school because you had a lack of security? And what's the brand damage that's actually going to do to your business? That's really where we push our selling points is how much more can actually go wrong because there's more to it. You know, if you look at a Bunnings, for example, I use this example all the time. There is nothing you can steal from Bunnings that will stop them opening tomorrow. Literally nothing. And even if somehow you stole every single thing there so there was nothing to buy, there's another one 5 minutes away. It's just not a problem for them. You know, so for them, it's just they'll do the bare minimum most likely because, you know, what's really going to happen? We're so big, we've got all these things in place. So the point is, if you go to a local mechanic, you know, and it's a husband and wife run business, maybe their kids work there too, it's their entire livelihood. If something happened or they got injured, even, you know, is a big concern for small business owners, the money stops coming in. You know, that you can really affect a business like that with a very simple crime. Mm. You know, we've been to more than enough ram raids where you're standing there with a business owner and you think, does he care about the loss of stock? Probably not. But does he care about the hole in the front or the car that's just driven through his front desk and now he can't put a staff member there to sell anything? You know?
But how would a security prevent something like that from happening?
It's all appearance. You know, a lot of it comes down to appearance.
It's kind of like if you're going to rob a house, one has a Rottweiler and the other has no dog. Yeah. You're like, I'll just go to the one without the Rottweiler in it.
There's actually more serious crime, I guess, than people realize. We've been to some very big retail break-ins. I won't name them, but let's say a large suit supplier is an example. Someone's not just going to walk in and steal a suit. Like there are people out there looking to steal 400 suits in a semi-trailer truck. It absolutely happens. And so what are those people going to do? They're not going to just turn up and get an angle grinder out and hope for the best. They're going to come along and they're going to kick a door and set the alarm off and then go sit across the road and see who turns up. Does anyone turn up? Is the guy turning up on his phone and not paying attention and just quickly checks the door and drives off? You know, or does a dude turn up in a serious-looking car and he's got all this equipment and he's on the radio and he's got a torch out and he's checking things properly and he's got keys to go inside and make sure there's no one in there? Why would you break into that business? And that's what we focus on.
And that's what people do. So that's what, like, criminals looking to break into companies. They test, they try before they buy.
Yeah,
you know,
they're not in the business of going to jail. They're in the business of taking your stuff. And we see it on building sites all the time. Unfortunately, building sites, it's normally the staff stealing everything. And so we'll find, you know, we speak to builders all the time that have stories about, oh, we're broken into 3 times this week, you know, and it's like, were you broken into or did they just take it home with them?
Well, they're already in.
Exactly. And so we'll come in and we'll put up all these CCTV and put guards there and all this stuff. And you can tell who's watching you too closely, like, geez, better go somewhere else now. And so we just have to find those people. We have to find the people that have been affected too much to turn a blind eye to it.
And, I mean, you mentioned it yourself. You weren't educated in business and you weren't experienced in business. What were the biggest problems that came, like what were the biggest challenges that you've had as an entrepreneur growing such a large business with no training or education or experience or education?
Yeah. There's a lot, obviously. And I think for most people, the biggest challenge is starting, because you can actually, anybody with minimal business education or watch a YouTube video that talks about the skill sets you need to start in business, anyone can watch that and go, too hard. You know, like, how am I going to think of all that? Or you can just go, here's something I know how to do or sell or provide or whatever it is. I'll just start doing it and back myself to know that when the problems arise, I'll fix them and people like me enough to help me and I'll just ring around and ask for help and we'll make it happen. And that's what we did. And, you know, some of our biggest problems have been, of course, hiring staff. You know, that's always hard. That's more at scale. You know, when you're smaller, your problems are like, how are we going to pay these bills? You know, because we've got this one customer that isn't paying and that's a majority of our income because we're only new and they're 30 days late and we're too scared to call them because what if they leave us to go somewhere else, you know, and all these things start playing in your mind. And then things finally kick off and now your problems are like, you know, we've got $1 million in sales, but they're all on 45-day accounts, but we've got to pay our staff this week. How do we find a lender to either lend on our invoices or whether it be equipment financing or whatever the solution needs to be? And then how do you vet that person? That's how you get burnt. It's because you don't know what you don't know. And when you're speaking to these services, they can see the holes in your business and that's all they're going to talk about. And so that makes you think you've got the solution. And that happened to us with marketing. You know, we spent 70 grand on marketing in our second year and it almost put us under because we were convinced by a marketing guru, just get a loan. I guarantee you'll get $2 back on every dollar. It's simple. You know, and it's like, sounds good to me. And you go and get the loan and then our ROI on that was like $500.
Well, me and Laura were literally having this conversation. Was it yesterday? I was going off about, I can't remember what, but I was saying that every time, oh, that's right, someone was trying to charge us for I think branding services or something like that.
Yeah.
And I was saying to the rest of the team, I was like, every time we've ever like outsourced, like, we've listened to someone that was going to get paid. They were saying that because they were going to get paid. Like every time it was just the biggest waste of money and we ended up doing it ourselves after they had, we had wasted all that money with them and we did it better. And,
yeah.
And I was like, you know, we like, you can't listen to people who are trying to get money from you. Yeah. You have to listen to like your friends that are also in business and have had experience or mentors or people that are part of a community that you're part of. Like they're going to tell you the truth and like what I did. Or if they did use someone and they said that person was amazing, you know, at least you trust that, okay, well, they used them and, you know, why would they pass them on if they weren't great? Like having that system. But when you start having people be like, oh, like we had an event for Boa this morning, which is the like early stage business platform we've got. And Alan Dibb, have you ever read the One Page Marketing Plan, that book?
No, I haven't.
It's actually a fantastic book on marketing, but he was like, he was telling people, one of the Boa users asked him, he's like, look, I'm telling people what's wrong with their business, but no one's buying off me. And Alan goes to him, it might be in the delivery, because when you go to someone, you say, oh, this is bad, this is wrong. Like they're going to hate you straight away. Like you shouldn't be telling people this is bad. You should be, you know, talking to them, discussing the situation and helping them come to the conclusion that they should be making an improvement themselves. Because if you say this, like if you insult someone essentially, like they're going to be like, get the fuck out of my face. I don't want to talk to you. Like I'm not going to give you my money.
I'll talk to the guy that talks to me nicely and tells you everything's great.
Exactly. Like it was, I can't remember how we started talking about this, but.
Look, I actually, so one of the early people I got into is Grant Cardone. And for motivation more than anything, because he's a crazy dude and I like that about him. But he had something to say about this that's always sat with me, which is if you were busy doing what you know you should be, which for most businesses is just cold calling or door knocking or jumping online and doing more posts, 10 times more posts than everyone else, is what Grant Cardone would say. If you were busy doing the things that you probably already know you should be doing, then you would be too busy to be sold by these gurus. And it's very true, because most businesses don't start because they've got so many sales, they need to find something to sell these people. Most businesses start because they have something to sell and then you have to figure out how to sell it.
Yeah. It's kind of like the difference between actually doing something that's going to help you gain clients or do anything or improve anything, actually do or make your clients happy, you know, or reading about doing something.
Learning or we all know what could what we should be doing. But often when we speak to these isolated services that are trying to solve a problem for us, we're trying to solve that problem because we don't like doing it or we don't know how to do it.
Yeah. And it's also easier to sit there and read about it than it is to just start trying.
Yeah.
It's kind of like what you're saying about starting a business. Like, I agree, that is the hardest stage of business. Yeah. Not literally the hardest to achieve, because that first 3 years is by far the hardest to achieve. But it's the one that most people trip on. Mm. Like, I reckon more people trip at that step than trip at the within the first 3 years step. Yeah. And it's purely because they sit around thinking about, oh, what am I going to do? Should I do it? Is it good? Like, you know, sometimes if you just do it, the actual thing, like if you want to start a business and you actually just start it, like you're stuck. You know, you have to make it work. And it's like, okay, I need clients. How am I need think about how I'm going to get clients as opposed to just doing something that's going to get you a client. Like, even if, because it's always also good to have a plan in a sense, but even if you just started without a plan, you're like, and did the thing you thought was most likely, at least you've started.
You're halfway there.
Then you figure it out. Once you've started, you're like, okay, how could I do that better? Then I could do this and this. Okay, good. Now this, that, now that, then now that that's working, that's going, what else can I do to like, you know? And so it also makes you focus on one as opposed to being like, I'm going to put a marketing plan together. These are my seven mediums and I'm going to have this plan, you know, as if you're going to somehow magically make all seven work, you know?
Like, and I think a lot of people overthink it and spend too much time trying to perfect it. You know, I read The Lean Startup fairly early on in our business, and it's the idea of putting out something that you know has got flaws, but let the market tell you what the flaws are, because otherwise you could spend weeks or months or thousands trying to fix something that wasn't that important or didn't resonate with the buyer or, you know. And I think for a lot of businesses, it was certainly true for us, I think it's true for a lot of people, to go from zero to $1 million is, you know, there are a lot of businesses that don't go past $1 million. It's probably the majority.
99% of businesses.
Yeah.
And which so would be like three, four million.
It's a huge amount. And a lot of people are employed by those businesses too. But once you do get there, to go from 1 million to 5 million is not that hard, because if you can make $1 million, you're just doing five times more of whatever that is to get to 5 million. And the problems aren't five times more. Most of the systems you'll have to get to $1 million will probably get you to five. Five to 10 is really hard. Once you cross 10, it's like another
They're different
world.
Problems.
Yeah. And they're problems that are so much harder to solve, you know, for simple things like your payroll at a business under $1 million, if something goes wrong and you run out of money or you need something just to get you through one more week because some customer is going to pay you in a week and it's going to help you out, you know, to find 20, 30 grand is not that hard, you know, but when your payroll is 200 grand a week, no one just gives you 200 grand. You know, early on, a friend of mine just gave us 30 grand. He was a business owner as well. And we just needed to bridge a gap, similar story. And he's like, here you go, just give it back. We gave it back, no problem. I don't think I've got a single number in my phone that will just give me a few hundred grand to get through the week.
Yeah, they're different. They become different problems. Yeah. You know, the problems, the earlier stage problems are, how do I make this work?
Yeah.
You know, the bigger problems are, how do I not screw this up?
Yeah.
One is a lot more attack, and then one gets defense. And then once the defense gets much better, like once you cross that 10 mil mark and your defense, you've done your defense for a few years, you're feeling good, you're feeling confident, then you go back to attack again, and it's that next big push. Yeah. But it does go up and down. It does fluctuate. We do need to finish because I see Laura twirling her fingers at me. Man, what a crazy industry.
It is.
Like, arrest people for a living but not police.
Yeah. Yeah, we work in a grey area. I'll give you some training. Come around.
100%.
Everyone wants to do it till someone puts handcuffs on you, and then you'll realize how much those things hurt.
Yeah.
And you probably don't want to be involved.
Yeah. I don't think that's for me. I get claustrophobic and I wouldn't do well in a confined space. Yeah. I'd probably go crazy. But thank you so much for coming in. So happy to hear that you're loving Cub and man, I'm sure you'd have a lot more. We should grab a beer or something, because I'm sure you'd have a lot of crazy. I wanted to ask you some more stories.
Yeah, I've got some that are definitely for off record too, let me tell you.
Well, I look forward to hearing them. But to our listeners, if you want to catch up with or get in touch, with Richard, you go to cub.club/podcast and you can contact him or get in contact with him there, as well as find his greatest lessons in business, favorite books and other cool information. If you want to catch up with Cub, you go to Club of United Business on Instagram. It's also awesome there. Thanks so much for coming back on.
Thanks for having me.
Hope you enjoyed the show.